Class in the letter of 1 Peter, and we're ready for chapter 3 tonight. And we just have tonight and next week to kind of finish up, so it is something of a little bit of an overview here. We could go back and look at some of these things in a little more detail, obviously, but at least as far as the big picture is concerned, here's a basic outline. This is just a briefer form of what I handed out to you. And we saw in the first major section that we are born again to this living hope, the people of God, a new Israel, and that there are certain behaviors and conduct and so on that are expected of us as God's people. And then the second main section, Peter turned his attention to the responsibilities or obligations we have toward people in this world and the relationships that we have. To the government, to our slave owner, to a wife, to a husband who may not even be a believing Christian. And now, beginning in chapter 3 and verse 13, Peter finally gets around to dealing with the specific problem which motivated, or apparently the reason why he wanted to write the letter, which is persecution or suffering. And it's only now that he begins dealing with that problem directly. Now, of course, he's been really dealing with it from the beginning, in essence saying, you don't really need to worry about suffering. That's not the main thing. The main thing is, fulfill the great commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, and to love your neighbor, your fellow man, as yourself. And that's exactly what we found in that first half of the book. You do what's right by God. You do what's right by your fellow man. Fulfill your responsibilities that you have and all of these obligations, and things will be fine. God will take care of the rest. You don't need to worry and fret about that. You don't have to take charge and be in control and make things all work out the right way. God will do that in His own good time. And so this latter part of the letter explains why it is that we suffer. But this section also kind of falls into two parts, and it goes in reverse order of what we've had to begin with, continuing on from this old community perspective. The fact that we're still part of this world, we live in this world. Peter will address our suffering in the context of what purpose it can serve the Gentiles, what impact it will have on other people. Then, beginning in chapter 4, verse 12, he's going to deal with our need for suffering that is, you know, irrespective of our connection with this world. It's looked at solely in light of our relationship with God. And so we're going to try to look at this section, chapter 3, verse 13, through chapter 4, verse 11, and see if, in fact, it is not the case that Peter addresses this question of suffering in light of the world in which we live and the effect and impact we can have on it. To look at a more detailed outline of this particular section, once again, it kind of has one of these chiastic patterns, ABBA pattern. And I've chosen the word proclamation to draw attention to what I see as the theme throughout this section. Not that the word proclamation actually occurs in each one of these sections, but it gets at the idea that what our behavior and lives do is announce or proclaim the gospel or say something about God and our faith in Him to the world in which we live. And the section begins and ends with this idea of glorifying God, sanctifying, regarding Christ as holy, glorifying God. And then the internal part of this, Christ is brought up as an example once again, and we are then urged to follow that example. And so we'll trace that as we go through here. So first, let's look at chapter 3, verse 13 through 17. And before we actually look at that, I'll see if there's any loose ends or leftovers or unfinished business. Maybe we stopped in the middle of chapter 2 and I've forgotten. Didn't remember where we were. But okay. Well, chapter 3, beginning in verse 13. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. Now do not fear their fear, nor be troubled. But in your hearts, sanctify Christ to be the Lord, always ready for a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. That skipped a slide. Yet with gentleness and fear, keeping a good conscience so that in the thing in which you were slandered, those who revile your good conduct in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. And so notice verse 13, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? Now, when Peter says that, I don't know about you, but what's the first impression you get of that kind of question? How do you want to answer that question? Everybody. Are you kidding me? Everybody and their dog can harm me. That's what. And of course, some people actually take the view that Peter is kind of naive and oblivious and all that kind of thing. And that's just nonsense, because in verse 14, he turns right around and says, even if you should suffer. And that if that he's using there again is assuming that in fact is the case. It's not just a hypothetical if, they in fact are suffering already somewhat. But even then, they are blessed. And so this is one of those cases again where we're really redefining words. And the Bible does that an awful lot. Throughout the Old Testament, there's this theme that you will not understand even though someone explains it to you. Lord, who has believed our report? The stone the builders have rejected is the one the Lord has chosen as precious and valuable. You get this all throughout the Old Testament. The way God does things is completely upside down and backwards to the way it's supposed to be done right, the way the world thinks. And in the same way, God's always turning words upside down on their head, so to speak. And so the cross is not shame, it's glory. It's not defeat, it's victory. It's not weakness, it's power. Now, you're not going to convince a lot of people of that, but that's God's perspective, and we have to decide whether we're going to look at things the way God does or not. So, let's think of this word harm. What qualifies as harm? That's really what Peter, I think, is getting at. And our conditioning is to think of harm in terms of what? Physical, financial, our freedom, our health, our life. Those are things that we can be harmed in. Peter's just thinking of one thing, and what's that? Yeah, your soul. Don't fear those that can destroy the body, but the one that can cast both body and soul into hell. It's the same kind of thing. It's just like we've talked before about man's problem. You learn a lot about a religion when you boil it down and say, what does this religion think man's problem is? And if you think man's problem is he doesn't have good enough plumbing, well, then the only thing that would really qualify as a blessing from God is fixing everybody's plumbing, right? That's the problem. But the Bible affirms to us that man's problem is sin, and therefore if God is going to bless man, the only thing that qualifies as a blessing is the forgiveness of sins. And you see Paul reasoning that way, for example, in Galatians chapter 3. It says, how do I know the Gentiles are saved by God, forgiven of their sins by faith? Because God made a promise. In your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Well, the passage only said they were going to be blessed. He didn't say they're going to get forgiveness. Maybe that blessing was going to be big TV screens or something. No. The only thing that qualifies as a blessing is salvation, because that's what man's problem is. You know, if a man who's lost in sin, and you say, here's a new TV. What does that mean? That's nothing, because I'm in sin. And it's the same way here. Government's going to take your life. Government's going to confiscate your property. That's nothing. That's like, you know, if I were to say to you, the government's going to come by and take some of the dirt out of your yard. Fine, you know. It's going to come take the mosquitoes away from your yard. Oh, wow. Ooh. We're going to have to get my gun out and defend my mosquitoes, you know. I mean, we'd be like, oh, well, they're welcome to them, you know. They're worthless, you know. I don't need them anyway. The only thing that is of value to the Christian is are those things that are eternal and spiritual. So this is one of the great blessings the Bible emphasizes to us. It is a comfort, because it didn't have to be this way if you think about it, but it is a comfort to know there is not one thing that anyone can do to harm you. It is not within the power of a single human being on the face of the earth to destroy your relationship with God, to separate you from the love of God. There's not one thing anyone can do. It is solely within your power to go along with their influence. They can certainly try to persuade us or pressure us and so on. But it ultimately comes down to whether we give in to it or not. And again, that is a comfort, that there is no power in this world that can make us sever our relationship with God. And so there is no harm that can come to us from without. We can hurt ourselves, certainly, but we don't need to worry about these other things. So that's what brings us to verse 14, which you may have a Bible that indicates this is a quotation from the Old Testament. And it comes from Isaiah chapter 8, "Do not fear what they fear. Do not be troubled." So now we're redefining fear. What are you afraid of? Well, again, you're afraid of what harm is. And if harm is losing your money or losing your liberty or losing your life, well, those are the things you fear. But if the only thing you fear is losing your relationship with God, that's the only harm that there really is, then that's all that matters. Now notice this passage from Isaiah chapter 8, and I've just put on the screen verses 11 through 15. But see if you can recognize not just the quotation, but other things in this section of Peter as well. "For thus Yahweh spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, 'You're not to say a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy. You're not to fear what they fear or be in dread. It is Yahweh of hosts whom you shall regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. Then he shall become a sanctuary, but to both the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Many will stumble over them, and then they will fall and be broken and snared and caught.'" And you recognize part of that is from back in chapter 2, where we had the rock imagery used, that Jesus is a rock, and either a rock people are going to build on or a rock people are going to stumble over. Well, part of that discussion came from Isaiah chapter 8 already. And now, this particular part that's quoted in verse 14, "You don't fear what they fear or be in dread." And this is, I think, an obvious case where we don't just look at this, you know, snippet that's quoted from the Old Testament and used in the passage. You're intended to understand what this whole chapter is about, this whole section of Isaiah, and see how that helps you to understand what's going on here. And, of course, Isaiah goes on to say, "You will fear the Lord. You regard Him as holy, and you fear Him." That's what you fear. You don't fear these other trivial things these people are afraid of. And so we then set our fear on God. Now, Peter doesn't say that. He doesn't draw explicit attention to that, but that would be the implication, certainly. But I do think, in a way, he is alluding to that and making that point. So now let's look in verse 15. "Sanctify Christ to be Lord in your hearts." Now, where did Peter get that? See, that comes from Isaiah 8 also. Now, it's not a direct quotation per se, but it is very clearly a reference to this. "You shall regard the Lord as holy." You see, sanctify means to make holy, to consider holy. Who are we to consider holy? The Lord. But who's the Lord? The Lord is Christ. And incidentally, it's one of those many passages that show that Yahweh God that we read of in the Old Testament is embodied in Jesus Christ in the New Testament. Yet I think we often make the mistake of thinking Yahweh is the Father, God. No, Yahweh is God, and that embodiment of Yahweh is in Jesus Christ in the New Testament. But you regard Christ to be this Lord who you're thinking of as holy. And then what goes along with that is you need to be ready to make this defense, this verbal, rational argument, when you're challenged and someone says, "Hey, why are you such an idiot and believe all this nonsense?" You need to be able to defend the reason for the hope that is in you with gentleness and fear. And again, some translations use reverence, and it's because we have this difficulty again of finding really an appropriate English word to really convey the idea. Respect and reverence really are too light. Fear may leave the wrong impression, because certainly when the Bible talks about fear, we're not talking about terror. We're not being in terror of God, but we do have a fear of God, as Isaiah is talking about here. Fear the Lord and honor Him, regard Him as holy. Now that is to be applied to Jesus Christ. And so Peter is calling Christians to this relationship they have with the world. People are going to ask you, why do you have this hope? And you need to be able to give an answer for it. And now notice in chapter 3 and verse 16, keep a good conscience so that in the thing in which you are being slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. And so once again, what Peter is envisioning here is you are being slandered, you're being accused of wrongdoing, and you could easily fear what's going to happen as a result of these accusations and what people might do about it, but you just fear the Lord. You worry about doing what's right by God, and everything else will take care of itself. It's better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. So you just continue to do what is right. That's the point here in 1 Peter chapter 3. So notice again, Peter expresses this in terms of what impact it has on people around us. That we conduct ourselves with gentleness, with reverence, keeping our behavior properly, doing the right thing, and that will have, again, a positive impact on the people around us. Comments, or Shane?
Well, when we talk about the fear of the Lord, and then when we look at passages like this, and then there's others, that, you know, fear not those that can destroy the body only, but,
right.
Is this fear, are those opposites, or are they different words, and then just our English word of fear sort of overlaps?
Yeah. You know,
obviously, the fear of God just means a healthy respect for God, power and his authority, and not that we're running around, you know, cowardly and afraid of him. And by the same token, we're not supposed to be cowardly afraid of those that can destroy the body, and yet, you know, when somebody threatens you with harm, I mean, it's a natural emotion to be, you know, scared in that situation, but is it talking more about not having, you know, respect of that person that would destroy the body?
Yeah, I think naturally anyone that threatened, you know, they're mugging you or something, you'd be a little concerned what they're going to do. But I think you hit the nail on the head. It's if you allow that fear to affect your conduct, for example, like you don't do the right thing out of deference to this fear that you have for whatever you might lose or what might happen, that's not proper. Well, the word is the same, but it's just like a lot of words, there's a range of meaning and often a play on words being made. And of course, it's always important to see what the whole Bible has to say about a particular topic. And you have to remember, for example, what John says in 1 John chapter 4, that perfect love, you know, casts out this terror kind of fear. But at the same time, it is love that builds a different kind of fear. So, for example, in my relationship with my wife, I don't live in terror of her. You know, I'm not cowering in the corner of my bedroom, you know, afraid I'm going to be beaten or something. And I hope she doesn't feel the same way about me. But I certainly have a lot of fears about her. I fear disappointing her, you know, things like that. And I think the same thing's true of our relationship with God. My kids are laughing at me. All right. So.
When I look at this passage, it comes to my mind, it brings a lot of encouragement to me. If I think about if we have more confidence in God's word, in God's offering of salvation to us. Because when he says, like, do not fear, you know, persecution, do not fear about having your possessions taken away. In the other end, he's saying, have confidence of the value of my gift to you. And when you recognize that, your ultimate, you know, it's not the time when you're being persecuted when you start questioning if God's plan of salvation is true. But if you already have that confidence, you naturally, when those things occur, you know, those thoughts, you know, hopefully won't embark on you.
Okay.
All
right. Adam?
Or do you think it's talking more about your respect to
Well, that is a question that comes up, and it was similar back when we talked about the relationship with Christians to the government, acting in reverence. And again, I would say ultimately it is reverence toward God. But, you know, just like the great command of loving God is really fulfilled in loving our neighbor as ourself, there's a sense in which that filters down, you know, anyway, the proper respect. So I don't know that we really have to choose, you know, between those two. All right, well, moving on. Here are just some quick questions. Do I believe deep down that nobody can harm me? That's a hard one for me to say yes to because, you know, I'm a creature of this world and I have all these fears I've been embedded with from the world around me. But, yeah, that's what Peter's calling me to. Really believe deep down that there is no harm that can happen to me that really counts, that's worth anything. Do I fear what others fear or do I fear God? How will I answer those who ridicule and challenge my faith? There's a kind of natural tendency to want to react in kind, insult in return, and that kind of thing. And will I still do what's right even if it means more suffering for me? Those are just some thought questions to think about. All right, moving on to the next section. We're probably going to run out of time, but Christ is now held up as an example. So 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 18, and in the context here, again, continues to be glory through suffering. The glories of the Messiah that follow the sufferings of the Messiah. And we see some connections here between what's said about Jesus back in chapter 2, that, you know, to this you have been called, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example for you to follow in his footsteps. And basing a lot of that description on Isaiah 53, of he had no sin, no deceit, that he didn't retaliate in kind to the suffering that he was being given and so on. And what we saw an emphasis on back in chapter 2 with Jesus' example was his suffering. Now Peter is using the example of Jesus and building upon that and taking us now to the next level and really thinking in terms of Jesus' vindication. That it isn't just all suffering, it is suffering that leads to glory. And now we're getting more of the glory side of the story. And so he emphasizes the resurrection, the ascension back to the Father, the authority that he has in all of this. So you'll notice those emphases as we go through this. And, of course, the example of Jesus here is intended as something that we imitate. So, just like in chapter 2, we must walk in the footsteps of Jesus and suffer like Jesus, but the hope is also we will be glorified like Jesus, and we too will be vindicated by God. So even if we are harmed by some kind of worldly suffering, we will be vindicated where it matters. And also, I think there's a hint here that just as Jesus' suffering and vindication have a redemptive impact upon other people, I mean, where would we be without the suffering and glory of Jesus? Our suffering and glory can have a redemptive impact on other people too. And I think that's really the point that Peter is making here. We can. There's no guarantee it's going to influence people to do the right thing any more than Jesus' suffering forced everybody in the world to do the right thing. But when they look at this and they say, what kind of God, what kind of creator comes down and dies for his creation? There's only one answer. Well, I guess there's two answers. He could be completely lunatic God, which isn't worth paying attention to. But the only answer that really fits is this is a God who cares about his creation and he's willing to do whatever it takes to save them. And it wasn't the nails that held Jesus on the cross. It was his love for his creation. And so that is a very compelling testimony. Again, the world won't ever see it. The world is so caught up in their definition of power and success, you can't convince most people that that's really what's important. But there will be those few that will pause and look at the cross and say, yeah, I get it. It really is the greatest power in the world. You know, it's kind of like we picture this, you know, 6'6" guy, you know, 280 pounds, just rippling with muscles, and you insult him and he hauls off and pops you in the face and knocks you down. Well, that's power. Ooh, man, look how powerful he is. But that's no power compared to the guy who has the ability to do that, and he restrains himself. But see, we don't respect that kind of power. We don't go away and go, oh, I'm so amazed. Do you notice the restraint that guy had? He could have decked that fellow, but he didn't do it. No, we don't think that way. We're impressed when the guy decks the other fellow and go, yeah, we'd like to see some more of that. Because that's how we're conditioned. But God shows this restraining power. You know, God could have, you know, frankly, if God were like me, he'd look down at the world and go, you're incinerated. I'm done with you. You know, my patience for myself is like nanoseconds, you know. But where would that leave us, you know? That would accomplish a lot of good. But it's God's patience. God is restrained by his great love for us. And so there is this redemptive appeal that it has, that some people are going to be touched by that and say, what do I owe such a God who loves me so much and who has done so much for me? That's how Paul asked the question in Romans chapter 8. If he delivered his own son over for us, will he not also give to us all things? Do you think there's one thing God will withhold from you? If he gave you his son to redeem you out of your own stupidity and your own sin and your own rebellion, and all the while doing that while you were still spitting in his face, do you think God's going to hold anything back from you? He will give you all things in Jesus Christ. And so that's kind of the point. So, verse 18, Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made proclamation to the spirits in prison, who once were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is eight persons, were saved through water, which water also now correspondingly saves you, that is, immersion, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him. Now, we don't have time to explore all of this, but basically there are three different views people take of this verse 19. Jesus went and made proclamation to the spirits in prison. You have the view that after Jesus died and before he was resurrected, Jesus went down to the Hadean realm and he preached the gospel to all the dead people there to give them a chance to come forward and be baptized or whatever and become Christians, because those poor dead people didn't have any chance when they lived on the earth because Jesus hadn't lived yet. I'm not the least bit partial to that view or think it fits what the Bible teaches at all. Probably a more common view that most Christians I know hold is that in the days of Noah, Noah preached to people, inspired by the Spirit of Jesus, telling them, judgment is coming, you need to repent, get on the boat, you'll be spared the judgment of God. They didn't listen, they disobeyed, and so they died in the flood, and now where are they? They're locked in the prison of Hades, awaiting their judgment until that day should come. And the third view is that, in fact, these spirits that are being talked about are not the spirits of people, but evil spirits. One thing that this view has going for it is that whenever the word spirits is just used by itself in the Bible, it always means evil spirits. And so that may be what Peter intends here. And so it doesn't describe any actual preaching trip that Jesus makes. It's simply when he goes to be with the Father, when he ascends to his throne, seated at the right hand of God, the spirit realm knows that its days are numbered, that God has broken in their little refuge and brought judgment against them, and their days are now numbered, and their final judgment is approaching, and so on. And of course, that fits in quite well with what this is saying at the end, that he's at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven after angels, authorities, powers had been subjected to him. And this view takes the view that the proclamation simply was the word getting out, the announcement that Christ is victorious, the forces of evil are defeated. But that's really not the main point of the passage. The main point of the passage is Jesus is glorified. Jesus is vindicated. Yes, he suffered in the flesh. He was put to death in the flesh. But he is raised again. He has ascended back to the Father. He has all power and authority. And so that's what Peter wants us to be particularly thinking about, of course. Okay?
In the second explanation, why would Jesus take the occasion of the flood to speak to the evil spirits?
Oh, well, you mean the third view, the evil spirit view that we're talking about? Well, that probably gets a lot of detail that, you know, it's beyond what we can cover here. I think, obviously, Peter is using the flood story as an example of a time of judgment. I don't know that that was the only story he could have used. It, of course, plays in nicely with his intention to use the figure of water as a means of salvation, as a figure for baptism here. And that may be the only reason for any of these views that he mentions the flood in particular. It wouldn't have to be for any particular reason necessarily.
Yeah, so that was my question. Does he make an explicit connection between the spirits and the flood? Is he saying there's some kind of time connection?
Yeah, there wouldn't have to be.
He just shifts and now he talks about Noah. And
So there wouldn't have to be. And I think another thing that may be present here is any judgment that you pick from the Old Testament or any time up to the time of the crucifixion of Jesus, you know, those judgments are kind of model judgments of what the final judgment will be like. But without the final victory of Jesus, those judgments were only, temporary or limited or what you might want to call it. Jesus' victory is the first one in which you can say now the victory has been absolutely accomplished and it is assured. And so even after the cleansing of the world by the flood, you know, there was God delivering his people and punishing the wicked. And that's what always happens when God judges. But now there is a certainty to the victory of Christ that adds a new layer to it. And so we have the benefit, if we'd lived in Noah's day, well, we'd be dead, I guess. But if we had lived in after the time of judgment, we could look back and say, well, yeah, God's shown his judgment, but I wonder what the future holds and what's going to happen. Well, we live under the shadow of the cross, and we're able to say Christ is victorious. He reigns at the right hand of God. All spirit beings are subject to him. I don't need to fear any of these things. And so, you know, people, well, can demon possession happen today? Well, not for God's people. If you are truly in Christ and he truly has victory over all these things, that's not anything we need to worry about. Well, we'll have to move on. We can talk about this some more. I call verse 21 the only sinner's prayer in the New Testament because, you know, you hear it frequently talked about people in the denominational world. Just call on Jesus. And they leave the impression that you just kind of go out and look up in the sky and say, Jesus, Jesus. But as Jesus himself said, not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. So calling on God is more than just saying the Lord's name or saying a prayer. I think we get more insight into what's involved in calling on the Lord when you look at a passage like Acts chapter 22 and verse 16. Ananias says to Paul, what are you waiting for? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. And we get a similar thing here with Peter now. What is baptism? Well, it's not some magic ritual. It is appeal to God for a good conscience. You're calling on God, you're praying to God for a good conscience. God tells you to do this, you do it. Now, are you saving yourself? No. No more than Naaman, when he dipped himself seven times in the Jordan River, cleansed himself of his leprosy. You know, the seventh time he came up and his skin was cleansed of leprosy, he didn't jump up and down and say, well, look at what I did. I cured myself of leprosy. He knew it was happened by the grace of God, and yet did he have to do what God told him to do? Of course he did. And I don't know why people can't understand this, you know. God says, be baptized. You're not saving yourself when you do that. And Peter says simply, baptism saves you. Why? Because you've saved yourself? Because of a deed of righteousness that you've done? That you've earned yourself? No, because you're trying to do what God told you to do out of trust in him and have a good conscience before God. And so, anyway, we'll skip by that. Well, we're going to have to hurry quickly. Notice in chapter 4, now, the point of these first six verses of chapter 4 is to begin to make application. If Christ suffered, died for us, and has been vindicated. Now the connection is made explicitly by Peter. We need to do the same thing. So therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, which sounds just like picking up verse 18 again, Christ has died for sins, or Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example back in chapter 2, verse 21. So since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For the time is already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, blaspheming, but they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For the gospel has for this purpose even been preached to the dead, or for this purpose even the dead have been evangelized, that though they are condemned in the flesh according to men, they may live in the spirit according to God. Well, this preaching of the gospel to the dead in verse 6, of course, is another passage that's taken by those who say Jesus did go to the dead and visit them and preach to them. They say, well, that's what verse 6 is talking about too. And I don't think that's the point at all. Notice, first of all, flesh, as Peter uses it, typically means physical flesh. It's not the works of the flesh, or flesh as this sinful nature that man has, or this realm of sinful rebellion against God. For Peter, the flesh is the physical body, the material creation we live in. All flesh is like grass. You know, people are material bodies. We die. Jesus put to death in the flesh in verse 18. Jesus suffered in the flesh. Well, Jesus didn't suffer doing anything fleshly in the sense of a sinful way. He did live in a human body, a physical body, however. Now, there are a couple of possible exceptions to this. The fleshly desires that he mentions could be thought of as sinful desires, but they could also simply be read as desires of the body, of our physical bodies, the appetites that we have. But so what Peter is saying here is, we suffer in this fleshly existence we live in. We do suffer. God acknowledges that. Some of our suffering is because of our physical, material, bodily existence. What good can come out of that suffering is being done with sin. You know, a lot of our problem is our bodies get us into trouble. We notice all these drunkenness and drinking parties and sexual immorality and things like that. Well, that's what a lot of people think the body is for, and these bodily appetites leading us astray. But no, we know that's not what life is all about. And so you do without. You don't indulge yourself. You must exercise restraint. And that's a form of suffering of its own, that we don't just give in to all the demands of the flesh. Every impulse that we have, we just cave into it as a lust. So Christ suffered in the flesh. We need to suffer in the flesh. And the person who's willing to do that will be done with sin. I mean, a person who wants to sin, they're not going to be doing this painful, excruciating sacrificing of making themselves suffer and do without. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to be perfect. We're going to slip up and make mistakes. But the one who's determined to do the right thing is willing to suffer. I'm sick of sin. I don't want to touch it anymore. I don't want to be done with it. And follow the example of Christ. And the others, they're just indulging and going whole hog into all of these things. And you'll notice, just as God's people form a new Israel, we now have a new set of Gentiles. And who is a Jew and who's a Gentile is no longer determined on racial or ethnic grounds. It's those who are God's people and those who are not God's people. And so some Gentiles could be in this new Israel, and a lot of the old Jews could be now the new Gentiles. So you note that. But as far as the actual preaching to the dead, I think what we simply have here is he's mentioned that God judges the living and the dead. That's a kind of stereotype phrase that means everybody. You know, nobody escapes the category of living and dead. And there are two places then in the Bible where the writer goes on to comment on the phrase living and dead. Paul does it in Romans 14. And Peter does it here. It's almost like saying, hey, and talking about the dead, you know, the fact that God even judges the dead. I mean, you think about that. Who can judge the dead? That's not something people can do. Now, there have been cases like with John Wycliffe, who translated the Bible into English. You know, they dug up his body several years later and burned it and spread his ashes. You know, that'll show him. You know, well, that's just silly. You know, that's symbolic silliness. People can't do any kind of judging that impacts the dead, but God can. And that's part of the way of emphasizing the authority that God has. So the question comes up here, are we talking about physical death or spiritual death? And are we talking about Christians that are now physically dead, and they had heard the gospel at one time and became Christians, and now they're dead? Or is Peter saying these are people that are not Christians, they're spiritually dead, and they hear the gospel and are able to obey it? Either one of those are possibilities for that particular expression. Now, the last thing I just simply want to point out is how often this one another comes up. The end of all things is near, therefore be of sound judgment, sober spirit, and the purpose of prayer. Above all, keep constant in your love for one another. Be hospitable to one another. Employ whatever gifts we have to help one another, serve one another. And he mentions particularly the gift of speaking as the utterances of God and serving with the strength of God. But notice, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. That's the goal of all of this. And so again, you see, why do we suffer? It does have an impact upon the people of this world, and ultimately it glorifies God. And that's kind of the short answer here. And then we'll look at another answer that Peter gives about suffering, beginning in chapter 4 and verse 12 and going through the end of the book next week. Well, again, it's an overview, like I said, and so we can't get into too much detail with this, but we'll finish up the book of 1 Peter next week. Thank you.